signs that this may happen are either you will see pass 1B, 1C, 1D happen, and then a huge number of inodes listed as being in conflict. And that can be a hint that your inode table has gotten corrupted. Or if you have a large number of inodes that have invalid block numbers. And very often what you will see is you'll look at the block numbers, and the block numbers are these really large nonsensical values, and then you translate them into ASCII, and you realize that a text file has been blatted into the inode table. And that's just really unpleasant. If you think that has happened, do an image level backup before you do anything else. FSCK is going to try to recover what it can, but you may be able to get more back by doing an image level backup before you do anything else. I'll talk about a command that may help called e2image, but really, this is one case where you're going to very likely go to backups if you can actually find your backup tapes, and your backup tapes are actually valid. So if the inode table has been trashed, for example, hardware failure, or the system administrator whom you just laid off accidentally runs MakeFS on the wrong disk, and of course you don't have backups, or the just laid off administrator has destroyed your backup tapes, what do you do? Well, the data may still be there. The problem is the inode table contains the pointers to it. There are a couple of things you can do. If you're trying to worry about user-level errors, there are some user-level delete and undelete programs that can help you. And basically what they implement is basically like the Macintosh patch can type thing. So instead of using RM, you use a delete command, and then they have an undelete command that's there. Or, of course, if you're using the GUI, either GNOME or KDE, they have that trash can that will work by not really unlinking the file. Unfortunately, EXT3, you can't actually do this, and that's a limitation in the current way we actually implement journaling. If you're using EXT2, it may be possible to save an unlinked file by trying to do an undelete operation. But that's only going to work, again, if you're using EXT2 and if the block or the inode hasn't been reused since the file has been deleted. And in general, you just simply can't guarantee that to be true. On the other hand, if you RM the file and then you immediately don't do anything else on the file system, you might have a saving throw. The debugfs lsdel command is the way that you actually recover it. And lsdel will basically search the inode table looking for inodes that were recently deleted, and it will sort it based on the deletion time. And it will tell you in this case that there's one file that was originally 624 blocks, and apparently 624 blocks are available. And if we dump that file, dump inode 12 to some file like temp recovery, maybe we can actually save it. This works for EXT2, but as I said, it doesn't work for EXT3. EXT3 has enough other advantages that the fact that you can't undelete files this way, most people don't actually consider that enough of a reason to stick with EXT2, but I do mention that, at least right now, this is EXT2 only. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. It's probably safer just to shut down or safely unmount the file system and then try to use debugfs to pull it out. You can, in this case, actually use debugfs on the mounted file system if you want to try to get it back right away. But you have to be a little bit careful about what commands you actually do. In this particular case, I'm not using the -w flag, so I'm not actually going to modify the file. I'm just going to try to read from it. So you can actually use this on a mounted file system. But in general, this is not guaranteed to work, right? So this is all sort of a crapshoot. The real answer is use the undelete program or don't, delete the wrong file in the first place. Yeah. Now, if you don't have that, or if your inode table is totally gone, or you're using EXT3, the other thing that you can do is what's called desperation searches, right? And this is useful, for example, If you're a grad student who has 12 years of research stored on a disk that has never been backed up, and believe me, this wasn't a hypothetical situation. This really happened, and it was an MIT grad student, right? They should have taken away his diploma just for that. But anyway, it might be possible to get it back. And one of the things you can do is just simply grep the entire disk, looking for whatever phrase might be in, your dissertation or your research notes or what have you. Grep-AB, B stands for binaries, because we're going to be grepping over the actual hard drive. Dash A means print the offset in absolute terms where you actually find the string. And this awk command will take that offset and translate it into a block number. And this is assuming 1K blocks where we have 1023 divided by 1024. If you're using a 4K block size, which is the default, you'll want to change that to 495 and 496 respectively. That will give you block numbers, and then you can use the command LDE, which is the Linux disk editor, to examine that block number and then sort of look around it and see if you can actually recover the blocks. EXT2 and EXT3 will try fairly hard to store files contiguously, and this can be a big help when you're trying to recover files in this particular way. But this is really sort of a desperation search. How do we avoid losing data in the first place? Did I mention backups? Do them, right? Automatic backups are a really good idea because that means you won't forget. A cool thing to do if you have a laptop is set up your laptop so that it checks to see whether or not you're on your home network, possibly by doing some sort of ARP command or pinging your local gateway. If you're on your local network, then do an automatic backup over SSH, maybe using rsync to your file server, and just simply have it happen automatically at 3 a.m. in the morning or some time when you're not likely to be up, just so that it happens automatically. All right? Disk space is cheap. In comparison to the value of the data that's actually stored on your disk, you can afford to have a couple of extra disks so you just simply have backups. Backups are just important for so many different reasons. Hardware failures, user oops, buggy programs. And you want to have multiple levels of backups. You want to have multi-level backups because you may not discover the file corruption right away. Right? You may only turn up a few days or maybe even a few weeks later. So if you have some sort of grandfather, father, child backup system, you're much more likely to be able to recover from that. Here is a very, very simple way of doing backups. I'm not saying that this is the way you should. There are programs like Amanda you can use. You can use expensive proprietary programs. My colleagues in IBM Tivoli would love for you to use the Tivoli backup programs, but use anything. The only reason why I show you these scripts is just to show how easy it can be. And that there's no excuse not to do them. What I do in this particular case is I've got incremental scripts that are run automatically out of etc.cron, and I just simply always do a backup. So this is how I do a full backup, and I'm just simply using tar, and I touch a timestamp, and I just simply write it out to a fixed directory, and then there's an incremental backup that just simply backups all files that are newer than a certain time than the last full timestamp. There are multiple ways of doing it. In this particular scheme, I just simply back up everything to U1 backup, and then every so often I come in with a CDR and I just simply write everything onto the CDR. If you've got a lot of data, it might not work that well, but the bottom line is something like this that happens automatically is fired out of cron. That sort of scheme of doing a disk-to-disk backup and then periodically writing it to removable media, it's a pretty good strategy. And there are many different ways of doing it. I'm not going to insist on any one right way of doing it so long as you do something. I've already mentioned SMART. SMART is an acronym for Self-Monitoring Analysis and Reporting Technology. I'm sure they came up with the acronym first and the word second. And here are some of the attributes that you can actually see when you look at the smart attribute. This is from a somewhat old disk. It's also a disk that you can see is failing now. And that's because the reallocated sector count has fallen below the critical threshold of 5. That means that there are no more reallocated sectors for this for this disk. And, you know, this would be a good disk to replace, like, right away. There are a couple of the first column is the current value. The second column is the worst that value has ever been. And the threshold represents the number which, when it drops below that threshold, it indicates that the disk is really in bad condition. So you can see for reallocated sector account, if it drops below 5, and these numbers, by the way, don't necessarily have any physical meaning. The threshold numbers here in the second, third, and fourth columns range between 0 and 255 and are scaled by some arbitrary amount that's not defined. It's up to the disk drive manufacturer. It's set up so that, you know, high values are good and low values are bad. So when it dropped below 5, we signaled that that meant the drive was failing now. The raw values is also units that are completely up to the disk drive manufacturer, although on some of these, for example, if you see, was it 5 from the bottom, temperature underscore Celsius, presumably that raw value is in fact the temperature in Celsius. So you can manually check the smart health command. If you load the smart suite package, you can just say smartcuddle-caph or smartcuddle-caph, which will return different attributes. The better way to do it is just simply do it automatically via the smartd daemon. And there's a config file, et cetera, smartd.conf. Read the man page for more details. This is just an example of the sort of things that you can do, which is to automatic online collections, do automatic self-tests, a long self-test once a week, and if there are any problems, send mail to a specified mail address. So that way, if there are any problems, you get notified via email, and you have a chance to deal with it before the disk really goes down for the count. Another really good idea to do is periodic checksums. There are multiple reasons why you might do checksums. One is you might be looking for an attacker who has rootkitted your system and installed Trojans versions of LS or the PS command or whatnot. And if you're trying to prevent against malicious data modification, then you actually need to use cryptographic checksums such as SHA or MD5. SHA's been broken, so MD5 has been broken and SHA has been bent. You're going to want to use, say, SHA-2, 256. SHA-1 is still decent for this. A good tool that will do the job is Integrit, and there are a number of other tools that are out there. But those jobs, basically, they're trying to prevent against malicious data modification. There's another class of problems which people don't think about as much, which is you want to try to detect accidental data corruption, right? As much as you think so, your hard drive is not out to get you. On the other hand, hard drives do introduce mysterious data corruptions far more often than we like to think actually happens in reality. And a really good idea to do is just simply to do a fast CRC over all of the files, then if the mod time has not changed but the CRC has changed, that's a hint that the disk might have twiddled some bits behind your back. The CFV is a good tool that you can use. It's implemented in Python, but it's actually pretty fast. I know Python lovers are going to like tar and feather me for that, but it's a fast tool. It also happens to be written in Python. You can be surprised or not depending on your religious leanings. It's pretty easy to use. You can create a checksum file, and it's very easy to verify all the files in that match the checksum. This is something that's relatively new, None of the distros do this automatically, but if you're using a recent version of E2FS progs, there's a command called E2image. And what E2image will do is back up the critical file system metadata, including the inode table, to a flat file. Now, you want to, it takes a while to run because it has to copy the entire inode table out. The inode table isn't actually all that big. For example, if you've got a 30 gig file system, running the E2image command will take about 30 seconds, and the resulting file will be about 100 to 200 megabytes. If you have that E2image file, it will help you recover in a number of situations. This actually requires relatively new versions of E2FS progs, 1.36 or 1.37, which is the newest version. You can find that in Debian on Stable or Ubuntu, and I believe Fedora Core 3 if you have the latest updates. This isn't in any of the commercial distros yet. On the other hand, E2image is there, right? So even if you don't have the latest versions to allow you to take advantage of the E2image file, you can still create them as a backup. And depending on how paranoid you are, it might make sense to, for example, in a cron job, do this once a week and just simply save a copy of the inode table somewhere. So what can you do with it? Well, one thing you can do, which is pretty straightforward, is you can run dump E2FS on the image file and you can see what's actually there. With debugfs, you can actually use the dash D command to specify the original device and then use dash I to specify the image file. And what debugfs will then do is use your raw device to find the data blocks and then read all the metadata blocks from the E2I file. And this is a way that you can actually get undelete to work for EXD3. All right, so EXD3 does truncate the image when it unlinks because of the way we had to implement it for journaling. We could have actually done it right, but the person who implemented it, Stephen, was decided, well, this was never guaranteed to work in the general case anyway, and it was a lot simpler to truncate the inode as you're unlinking it. EXD3 doesn't actually allow LSDEL to work correctly. On the other hand, what you can do is if you've been taking regular snapshots using E2image, you can use debugfs using dash I to specify the image file, dash D to specify the device, and now that's enough so that you can use the debugfs's ls, cd, cat, and dump commands to go through the file and then recover a deleted file. And in fact, this will work much better than LSDEL as long as your E2image backup is relatively recent. Obviously, if you're only doing your E2image once a week and you created the file 3 days ago, which you then unlinked, it won't be an E2image and you won't be able to get it back. But E2image can be useful in these sorts of situations. The other thing that you can do and again, this only works with the very latest version of E2FS progs, is you can actually restore the image file back to the file system, which is most of what you need to do to recover from a makefs. So for example, let me just do a quick demo right now. We're going to take, this is a copy of a root file system that I had on one of my systems, HTC1. It's 128 megs. I'm going to copy it to test.image. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an image file for it, test.image, test.e2i. And you can see that it completed pretty quickly. And on this 128 meg file, the e2image file was just 1.6 megs. As I said, for a bigger file, like say a 30 gig file, this will take about 30 seconds and be a bit bigger than that. Now what we can do is I'm going to, well, first let me show you what's actually there. So you can see that this is a root file system that I've just mounted on /mount. There's your Etsy directory. So it's all there. I'm going to unmount it. So there's the et cetera directory in /mount. Sorry about that. Actually, that's important. Remember that inode number, 18145. Now what we're going to do is we're going to run makefs on the test image. Right, so now, if we mount it, nothing there. However, if we use debugfs, we will now be looking at the data 18145. When you use the stat command, it will actually be looking, pulling that stat information from the E2 image file, and I can even list the directory based on the inode number, and you can see there's your Etsy directory. So this is enough for me to say, okay, I want to actually recover some file, like for example, let's say my Mati file. Let's see, where is the Mati file? Well, I'll just recover the inittab file, which is right there, 18899. And actually what I can do is I can just say dump. That number. I'll do ld.so.conf 18951. Temp ld.so.conf, and then I can look at it, and there's my ld.so.conf. So I can actually recover individual files this particular way. Again, debugfs-d. I can also do this -i. test.image, test.e2i. What this will do is take all the metadata that was in test.e2i and slam it back into the image file. Now, of course, if the data blocks are out of sync, this can actually do a fair amount of damage, but if your inode table has been completely trashed, this can be, you know, your best way to actually recover. Question? It does not include the indirect blocks. Well, makefs only initializes the inode table, right? Yeah, in that situation, this will be fine. If the indirect blocks, in the case of undelete, you're right, because EXC3 is still going to trash your indirect blocks. But in the case of, for example, your inode table getting corrupted due to a hardware failure, E2 image will be able to recover as of when you actually created the E2 image backup. So here I'm actually restoring the image files. Now, because makefs still zeroed the root directory, I'm still going to have to run fsck on the directory, on the image file. And you'll see that because the root directory is gone, there's all sorts of files that will end up getting linked to lost and found. However, all the data is there. So if we now mount this file system, you'll see lost and found, there's nothing there, but if you look in lost and found, everything is there. And usually there aren't that many files in the root directory, right? So, and if we look at one of these numbers, for example, 145, and you look at the contents of that directory, it's pretty obvious looking at the files in 18145 that it in fact is /etsy. And then now what you can do is you can, you know, MV it back. And you do that for each one within lost and found. And then at that point, you've largely recovered from a accidental makefs without actually losing any data. So that's sort of gives you a flavor of the sort of things that you can do with the E2 image file. Yeah, question? Yes, what you can do is you can use dump E2FS and specify, oops, let me pop out of this. So we're back in this directory. If you look at dump E2FS and you specify the image file, it will actually tell you, it will actually give you the file system UUID, When the last time the file system was updated. And so one of the things that you can do is you can compare the file system UUID to the file system ID of the actual original file and make sure that they're the same. Now, of course, if you just run makefs, makefs will have zapped the superblock and the UUID will not match. But except for the case where you're trying to recover from a makefs, a good thing to do is to actually use dump e2fs on the image file and sort of make sure that the image file and the file system you're working with sort of roughly correspond. If someone ran makefs with a different block size, or say a different number of inodes, then they will have smashed some data blocks. All right, potentially. Right? If they specified a smaller number of inode blocks, inodes, it's not a problem. But if they specified a larger number of inodes, yes, they may have smashed some data blocks, or if they again a different block size. In which case, when you recover, you will actually still get about 90%, 95% of your files back, but some of the files may be trashed. And unfortunately, there's no good way of determining what's there and what's not. You just sort of have to look and see. Question in the back? Okay, well, there are a couple of ways that you can actually handle that. One is you can just simply use a father-grandfather type approach and just keep multiple levels of backups. Another thing you can do if you're using LVM is do a snapshot. Now you can run a consistency check on the snapshot and actually make sure it's okay. And in fact, one of the things that actually makes sense to do. Unfortunately, none of the distros do it because the layout really makes it complicated to do it automatically. But a really, really good idea to do is, independent of whether or not you do the E2 image backup, is to periodically do a read-only snapshot of the file system, say 3 a.m. on a Saturday, and then do a consistency check. And that way you will notice consistency problems that may have crept in due to a hardware failure or an NVIDIA module or something like that, find the problem right away and not wait for the next forced FSCK before you notice a problem or before things have gotten really bad. And in fact, one of the things that you can actually do in that case is after you've created the read-only snapshot and run FSCK, if it's clean, you can use Tune2FS to reset the mount count and reset the time when you last ran FSCK. So that on the next reboot cycle, you're not going to needlessly do an FSCK. So in fact, if you do that sort of, once a month or once a week, depending on how paranoid you are, scheduling out of a cron job, you can actually make sure that you never run FSCK at boot time because you're periodically doing it during the off times. And then a really good thing to do, of course, would be after you do that, also do an E2 image after you've done the consistency check. Now, if FSCK-N shows that you've got problems, then what you do is you send email to the system administrator, and the system administrator can take that system down at a convenient time and fix it. Of course, it depends on what you're doing. I mean, if you've got a cluster and you're using blades, you might just simply just destroy the blade and just recreate it from scratch. But, again, if you have some precious, one singleton server, this type of approach can be really, really handy. Is there a question over there? Yeah. XD2 and EXD3. The file system formats are really identical. The only reason why we call it EXD2 and EXD3 is EXD3 has journaling, and we wanted to keep a simple reference implementation of how you would actually do a simple file system in the Linux kernel. And so we just have EXD2 and EXD3 in the kernel at the same time, but they're really the same file system. Question in the back.
Can you
are two aspects of that. One is just simply how do you do the backup? And databases have specific database-specific ways of doing backups to ensure that the database is consistent. Right? Just as with file system backups, we can create a read-only snapshot of the block device and then back up the whole file system. If your database is online, you either need to temporarily freeze the database so that you can do the snapshot, and that becomes a very database-specific thing, where you freeze the database, take the read-only snapshot, and then release the database, or you just simply use the database-specific backup command. Similarly, at the database level, again, we can make sure that the file system is consistent, but then you may have to do some sort of database consistency checker, and that becomes very application specific how you actually do that. Very often, the consistency tools for applications are not particularly rich, and the only thing you can really do is just simply do a backup. There are no magic answers here. It really depends on the application. So we're sort of running out of time, so I'm just going to skip over RAID because I think most people actually know RAID. I guess the one thing that I will mention here is that there are trade-offs between software and hardware RAID. Software RAID is cheaper because you don't need specialized hardware. You can RAID across different controllers. But hardware RAID also has its benefits. Very often hardware RAID, it will be more performant. Because it can have battery backed up non-volatile memory, you don't have to rebuild a RAID partition after an unclean shutdown like you have to do with software RAID. As far as using Linux's software RAID, I'll just refer you to the RAID how-to, which goes through a lot of details of how you actually use it. One important thing with a RAID array is in your init scripts, if your distribution hasn't done it already, make sure that the software RAID is actually set up to send email when some sort of RAID event happens. Because otherwise what can happen is you can have a RAID 5 system and you can lose a disk, and the RAID can just automatically fail over and not let you know that, in fact, it's time to replace the disk. And then when you lose the second disk, you start losing data. So make sure with the RAID system that someone is paying attention to whether or not you have a failover that's actually happened. This is really important. RAID is not a substitute for backups. All right? RAID will not protect you against media errors. It will not protect you against bus errors. I've seen situations where a RAID controller went insane, and anytime you tried to read from a block, it would scribble garbage on the other disk while it was reading from the disk. So a lot of people will think, I've got RAID, I don't need to do backups because RAID automatically has redundancy and nothing can be further from the truth. Just be paranoid. So let me just finish up by saying, again, backups is the best defense against data loss, right? There are all sorts of really clever things that we can do, and those are useful things for when backups didn't work or you didn't verify your backups and it turned out that the backup software really needed two tapes but it only wrote one tape and you didn't notice that it needed two tapes, what have you. So backups really need to be your primary line of defense. The second line of defense is noticing when you might have impending hardware failures. Smart is a really good tool for that. And if you have an impending failure, replace the disk before it actually really goes bad. And really, the third level is, the fancy recovery techniques. Someone once asked me, someone asked me just, I think, the last day or two, did I ever have to go on site, to some critical, important IBM, customer and, recover a broken file system since I'm the file system expert? And the answer is no, I actually haven't. And the main reason is in most enterprise environments, they've got enough backups that usually isn't the problem. The times when, I can remember the times when, for example, at VA Linux Systems, we had a high school intern who should have never been given the root password. mount one half of the software RAID, actually ran MakeFS on one half of the software RAID, mounted it, and then started untarring into it. Of course, we didn't have fresh backups, and I was asked to, like, you know, try to recover from it. And this was in the middle of the Linux World Conference, too. But, you know, that was just, you know, immature system administration techniques where we actually had to do that level of recovery, right? In the normal case, you have enough backups, that sort of thing isn't an issue. Now, if the worst case does happen, the important thing is not to panic. Figure out what happened, and then you'll know at what level that you have to actually go and start addressing the problem. And really, there's enough redundancies, particularly, you know, each level, you know, the FSC, if you look at the EXE2 file system, there's a fair amount of redundancies built into the file system. If you're using RAID, RAID adds another level of redundancy. If you're using backups, that's yet another level of redundancies. And with all those levels of redundancies, in general, you'll never lose your data as long as you, you know, do everything right. There's a saying, if you ever take aviation lessons, that the first mistake almost never kills you. The problem is the first mistake compounded with panic will lead to mistakes 2 and 3, and that's usually what kills you. But, you know, one failure should not wipe you out if you got everything set up correctly. So with that, are there any final questions? Yeah. Using USB and FireWire as backups. Any kind of backup is better than no backup at all. There are people who will think about, you know, is USB the right approach? Is writing DVDs the right approach? Should you just simply use, you know, RAID and just simply pull one of the disks and put it on a shelf? Any of these techniques can work. It really depends on how much data you have to back up. Some of these, you know, if you're using disks as backups or flash as backups, how long the backups may last, and you know, for example, if you're using FireWire to a spinning disk, in general, tape is going to have a longer lifetime than disks, just simply because there's enough spinning parts. And once you take a disk out and you leave it, you know, not spinning on the shelf, you know, you start running into mechanical breakdowns, and you know, the oil and the grease start breaking down, et cetera, et cetera. Tape in general is going to be, you know, more reliable for long-term backups. For short-term backups, maybe it doesn't matter a whole lot. On the other hand, part of the problem with tape is that good, you know, enterprise-quality LTO tape is not cheap, right? And for a home hobbyist, it may very well be that USB or, say, you know, burning regular CDRs or DVD-Rs is going to be a better approach, right? I mean, anything is better than nothing at all. And the real problem is just getting people to do something. I personally believe that CDs or DVD-Rs are going to be more cost-effective than using, you know, flash memory or you know, USB disks. But the bottom line is do something. You know, we can quibble over what the right thing is, but you know, yeah. Question in the back. Okay. EXT2 is designed for use on spinning media. Flash memory has a limited number of read-write cycles, and so EXT2 is just by definition not going to be good for that. That being said, modern flash disks have a large enough number of write cycles that you might not notice the problem. But you know, flash memory has certain performance characteristics that your best bet is to use some file system that's really designed for that. So. Yeah. Okay, I'm really out of time, and I know some people want to go get lunch. If you have any other questions, feel free to come up, and I'll answer them for a few minutes before I have to leave to go get lunch. So, thank you. in general, you know, you can use dump at QFS and compare. You know, the approach that I just discussed is not necessarily going to bring everything back anyway. And if you've got someone who is deliberately trying to destroy data, they can just use a wiper that will, you know, really ruin your day, right?
Just,
so,
they
you know,
DD slash zero.
Yeah.
Dump takes time, though.
It does, but, you know, that's why they run it at night, you know. That's why they run it at night before they leave after you've laid them off, and, you know.
Yeah. That subtle thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, at that point, I do something like what you described, but I'd probably fall back on a proper forensic tool.
Yeah, yeah.
And see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Where it goes.
Right,
thanks
yeah.
for that. Mm-hmm. Two quickies.
Yeah.
What do you recommend is the best file system for Flash?
Okay. If you have access to the underlying, if you have access to the underlying, direct access to the underlying Flash, right, because most of your compact Flash cards are actually designed so that you can actually stuff like a fat file system on top of it, because that's what digital cameras are using. There really isn't a whole lot you can do. I mean, they're sort of designed so you can sort of use fat on them, but, you know, it's not going to be ideal. For PDAs that actually give you direct access to the Flash, that's what the JFFS2 file system is for, which is Journal Flash File System 2. And that one, for example, relies on the fact that, you know, typical Flash, the boundaries are not 512-byte sectors, but 16-byte sectors, and you can, in fact, zero 16-byte sectors. And because very often with these PDAs, you're really constrained on the number of Flash, on the amount of Flash that you have, instead of aligning on 512 or 1K block sectors, they'll actually align on 16-byte Flash sectors, right? But that was designed work with direct underlying Flash. Right? Now, that's generally not the case for your standard compact Flash or, you know, USB-level Flash, which is going to try to look like a block device, in which case you don't have much choice but to use a disk-based file system. And for those, in general, people want to use FAT because they want to be compatible with Windows systems and other, you know your digital camera is going to be using a FAT file system. So, in general, you just end up using FAT because the rest of the world is using FAT.
But there's really no reason to prefer that over anything else.
Not particularly, no.
Use minus
A time. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you really want to use minus A time if you're going to be using EXC2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. The second one, just another quickie.
Yeah.
With you know, sort of the upper end desktop, lower end server hard drives, you might be using as like sort of a semi-offline mirroring thing where periodically just do an async mirror across to a second disk.
Sure. Yeah.
Given the trade-off between headware when you spin it down and spin motor where when it stays on 24/7, which way is best to go when you're after you've done a mirroring? Is it better to actually spin it down or is it better to leave it going?
For what kind of hard drive?
Oh, something like an IBM disk drive?
Yeah, it depends on which generation IBM disks are, but because there was one set where they really went aggressive on desktops, right? And that's where the class action lawsuits came from, and you know all the Slashdot articles. If you're only going to be using it, if you're only going to be rsyncing it once a day, I'd probably spin it down. And
so
it's
the
probably
wear on spindle motor is worse than the wear on
Yeah. Again, I mean, you can look at the specs, right? I mean, the thing about the Destar was that the Destar disks explicitly said that they were rated for an average of, I think it was 8 hours per 24 hours of usage. And it was explicitly labeled as such. The problem is people were using these disks in server configs. And the class action lawsuit was people were not expected to have, you know, should not have expected that kind of limitation, and, you know, no one reads the documentations anyway, right? So that was the basis of the lawsuit. You know, if you read the specs actually tell you the story, right? I mean, you know, the low-level specs actually do say, you know, so many load and unload cycles, you know, what the MBTF is. You know, all that information is there. It's just you got to pay attention.
Sort of balance
And you know, the other aspect is, you know, you may want to save power and worry about heat load, and there are a bunch of other concerns as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
So there's no easy answer to where it's spinning.
No. But you know, I mean, if you're only spinning it up to like back it up once a day, and then the rest of the time you're never going to use the disk, that's pretty clear cut. Just shut it down. And, you know, that's probably going to be that. I would probably not do it as much for spindle reasons, just because these days most people just simply put in the decent spindle motor. I'd probably do it mainly for power consumption.
Right.
You know.
We've got a couple of systems, not necessarily in the SDI wise, but they do just that. They back up, and at the moment I'm spinning them down. It's
right.
Like, well, is that going to, I mean, to save spindle stuff, but is that going to then turn around and buy some head crank?
Yeah, I mean, hell, and it may not actually make that much difference, right? Because the reality is that modern hard drives, really, they're only spec to last about 2 or 3 years, right? The other approach, which may be far more useful, and I've seen shops do that, is every say 2 years or every 3 years, they just simply proactively replace all the hard drives, right, before they even start failing. And I've seen situations where we were all using the same. Fujitsu, these were 2 gig drives, which will give you a hint about when the story was. And we had like 100 of them installed. And then what happened is, some magic date passed, and we started getting a failure every week. It's like, every week at least one of the drives went. And it was just like clockwork. But it's like, okay, all of these drives have hit the end of their useful lifespan, and it's time to just replace them all. And it was actually amazing how, how very quickly they all started failing. Because they all had similar loads placed on them because they were all NFS file servers and the load was pretty well spread out. They were all from the same manufacturing run and they just all died pretty much at the same time. So that's the other thing is so if 2 years have gone by, again, how cheap are disk drives, right? How much system administrator time will you take, even if you're doing regular backups, to have to restore from backups, right? You may be better off just, 2 years have gone by, replace the disk, right? Yeah. Right. Being down while you reconstruct your systems, right? And that, a lot of that will determine whether you do hot backups or just offsite tape, or do real-time mirroring and, you know, instant failover, you know, and, you know, basically a lot depends on how much are you willing to spend, right? You know, there's no right answer there. Unless you actually do a verification pass afterwards. Again, exactly.